This is the Nichols Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of February the 6th, 2017. Current Federal Tax Developments is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and by Nichols Patrick, CPE, a division of the Lascalzo Institute. This week, we're going to be going back to looking at standard developments after last week's tour of the not quite proposed regulations on the partnership audit regime. And our cases this week get a little bit interesting. The first case we're going to look at is going to look at a case where a taxpayer's last-minute changes made to their separation agreement doomed an alimony deduction for the taxpayer that was in court. The IRS gives us some comments on the proper tax treatment if you offer your employees a fixed indemnity medical plan. Third case, we look at the fact that percentage of completion method of accounting doesn't necessarily mean that it's limited to just construction contracts, although in this case, it wasn't clear whether the taxpayer had one or not. We then also get to two reasonable cause cases, and our problem is in both cases, the taxpayer lost on the reasonable cause defense. In the first one, a taxpayer was found not to have reasonably relied on the advice of a tax professional, ended up paying over $100,000 in penalties for failing to file Forms 5471. And in the second case, the district court from California told the taxpayer that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals does not allow any sort of reasonable cause defense for failing to pay trust fund monies over, since the taxpayer conceded he was a responsible person. That was kind of bad news for the taxpayer in that case. Well, we're getting into the time again, time of year, and we're just going to remind you we've got a few updates left to go. Going to say for those of you in Ohio, we actually have four separate updates that Butch Olson is going to be giving. The first one is going to come on the 14th in Cincinnati, the 16th in Toledo, 17th in Cleveland, and 24th in Columbus. Those courses are open. You can sign up for them now. The one in Columbus will also be webcast. These updates are going to be going over developments that are business related. So for those of you who practice in industry, controllers, CFOs, and the like, this is the type of course that's going to concentrate on those developments that are of interest to you. Going to kind of skip over the individual developments that wouldn't be as much interest to you in your job. So it's a useful course to show up for. I will be doing a very similar course called the Business and Industry Tax Update for the Oregon Society of CPAs. That'll be February 28th in the Portland, Oregon area. We'll be at the Society's offices in Beaverton putting on that course. So if you're in the Oregon area, that's also a place, if you're in business or industry, a useful, important course to pick up. If you're in public accounting, these courses are still useful to you. But again, we're presuming, given the time of year, that most of this is going to be an industry sort of an industry group, and these courses are going to definitely be geared to CPAs who are in industry and have to deal with taxes from the perspective of somebody who's inside the organization. Well, let's go ahead and take a look at our cases for this week, and let's start out with the case of Quintal versus Commissioner. That was Tax Court Summary Opinion 2017-3. That case came out on February the 2nd. This is an alimony case, and just whenever we're dealing with an alimony case, it's always important to remember the rules. We don't really care, for alimony purposes, what the court, the state court, called it. For the most part, unless they call it child support, we really don't worry about what they call it. Certainly don't worry about whether they call it alimony or not. Payments that are not child support are tested for whether they are alimony under federal law in a four-prong test. The initial four-prong test, found at Section 71B1, requires that the payment is received by or on behalf of a spouse under a divorce or separation agreement. By the way, that is a cash payment. Secondly, the divorce or separation agreement does not specifically designate such a payment as one which is not includable in gross income and not allowable as a deduction. Third, in the case of an individual legally separated from his spouse under a decree of divorce or separate maintenance, they can't be members of the same household. And number four, there's no liability to make any payment for any period after the death of the payee spouse, and there's no liability to make any payments in cash or property as a substitute for such payments after the death of the payee spouse. If a payment stream meets those four criteria, then we next check to see if it's child support. Well, it could be either first, limited, specifically designated as child support, in which case Internal Revenue Code Section 71C1 provides that it's not going to be taxable to the recipient, or it could be deemed child support. That's found at Section 71C2. And that's where payments are reduced on the happening of a contingency specified in the instrument related to a child, such as attaining a specified age, marrying, dying, leaving school, or something similar, or a time that can be associated with such a contingency. Now, in this case, we had Mr. Quintal and his former spouse. When they got to court, apparently they did some last-minute negotiating before they signed off on their agreement. And they struck out stuff, they pinned things out, they wrote in new things, actually struck out whole paragraphs and rewrote statements to fill in the gaps on those paragraphs. As the court would later comment, this probably wasn't the smartest way to go about doing things, at least for Mr. Quintal, the way things worked out. The document was, to put it mildly, not exactly a model of consistency, and there were some obvious errors. For instance, in an Exhibit B, it told us, it made reference to certain things would happen, you know, payments would continue as long as the child was unemancipated, with the definition as provided in this exhibit, and the exhibit never provided a definition. That was something got added, and nobody ever figured out that they should have said something. Actually, there was a definition of that in a whole different exhibit. And that second exhibit, Exhibit J, that B and J were going to cause some issues here. Now, Exhibit B was originally titled Alimony. But when they got to court, they struck that name out and they called it unallocated support. However, the text of Exhibit B, if you read it by itself, seemed to indicate that they were going to treat this as alimony. It said basically he would pay to his former spouse $900 per week. And basically, the payment shall terminate on the earlier of the death of Mr. Quintal or his ex-spouse's remarriage. And it finally stated that they acknowledge that husband anticipates the above payment is deductible to him and includable to wife. Now that's fine, but remember, if you remember our four conditions, we didn't say you could make something alimony by saying it would be taxable to the recipient and deductible to the payor. It said we could make something not alimony. But even so, the big thing that usually causes a problem is, does it terminate on death? And we have the specific language in here, it'll terminate on death. So clearly, this was originally designed to be deductible alimony. But now we've got a problem. Exhibit J, which talks about custody, support, and visitation, although it referred to his obligation to make child support payments, they lined that through, and they simply say, see Exhibit B, implemented wage assignment forthwith. And Exhibit J included a statement that because of disabilities of the children, etc., they may never become self-sufficient or emancipated. And they define the terms emancipation of minor children as occurring on the child's death, marriage, entering into military service, or graduation from high school or four-year college program. And the big thing in Exhibit J was this. In accordance with, and it's stated just like this, in accordance with Section 71B1B of the code, husband and wife explicitly agree to designate and hereby do designate all payments required in this exhibit as excludable and non-deductible payments for the purposes of Section 71 and 215 of the code. Now, that's interesting because, remember, that language is one that we found in our definition. If we include that language, we make the payments not alimony. Now, the real problem at this point is, what exactly did Exhibit J refer to? Now, the taxpayer says, no. That reference there is not meant to cross-reference back to B, despite the fact that Exhibit J cross-referenced back to B. But rather, it was meant to, you know, it really shouldn't be paid attention to. The whole, because nothing was exactly listed in Exhibit J as payments defined in J, that really, that clause didn't refer to anything, effectively. And rather, all the payments were Exhibit B payments, which clearly they had the intent of being deductible. He also said the whole point of their negotiation was to make sure that it would be deductible to him and includable by his former spouse. Oh, by the way, as you may have guessed, his former spouse did not include this stuff in income. The tax court said, well, thank you, Mr. Quintal, but here's the first problem. Under current federal law, we really don't care what your intent was. You know, we got out of the reading of intent issues long ago under these rules. We simply apply the four mechanical tests. And they said, here's your problem. Okay, we have two statements that appear to be at odds with each other. One said you expected it to be deductible, And then the next one says it shall not be deductible. They said, well, you know, a couple of reasons that we're going to have to go with it shall not be. First, you expect to be doesn't indicate for sure it won't be. And when you go on to say it shall not be, well, we're going to take that as overriding. When you cross-reference Exhibit J, the payments under B, the only reasonable way to read it, the way the court saw it, was that it brought in all the B payments down to J, and then J told us that no payments under J would be considered alimony income to the recipient spouse, nor alimony deduction to the payee husband. Now, this is kind of interesting because you do have to kind of wonder how the spouse got the idea it wasn't includable. She certainly did. We don't know, you know, how they ended up at that roadblock of if in fact they had intended for some of this to be taxable. It certainly appeared that there was at least some discussion of that on B, but it certainly appears that the changes that were made either by accident or by intention by the spouse ended up creating this payment, changing this payment into a totally non-taxable to the recipient, non-deductible to the payee spouse payment. Illustrates a couple of things. Number one, make sure that you actually look at the divorce decree and the final decree. In this case, one way we could get in trouble preparing a return is if the client gave us the initial draft, the unmarked up copy. In this case, and it's kind of counterintuitive, you think a marked up copy isn't the real one, but in this case, you needed the marked up copy. And secondly, you've got to read the copy. You know, it is very possible that Mr. Quintal might have been advised by his counsel that, in fact, it was going to be deductible alimony. We don't know. He never said that, but it's possible. But even if his counsel said that, remember, his counsel usually is concentrating mainly on state law issues, not necessarily somebody who has the tax background. In fact, quite a few family law attorneys will say right off, they do not give any comments on the tax consequence of this. That's why you talk to your tax advisor before we approve this off. So you have to read and check, be very careful. This shows just how easy it is to accidentally foul things up. And as we talked about a while back, we talked about a mix up when we had the sale of the corporation where they sold the wrong company a while back. You may remember that case back last year. Last minute changes do cause all kinds of neat problems. Dangerous to pull those off. Next up, we're going to take a look at the IRS gave us some guidance here on the taxation of a fixed indemnity medical plan. This is Chief Counsel Advice 2017-03-013. This was issued by the IRS on January 20th. In this case, we're looking at a fixed indemnity medical plan. That's a plan where if, let's say, you go in the hospital, the plan will pay you X dollars per day. They'll pay X dollars per day regardless of whether you actually incur that much in expense, or even without regard to whether that much in whether those expenses have been covered by your another major medical plan. An indemnity plan simply pays fixed dollar amounts on the occurrence of certain events, regardless of whether you incur expenses at that point. So you'll see programs like that. In many cases, the idea is to provide the employee with additional monies because we'll assume there'll be other expenses that could come into play that they might need if they end up having this thing happen, be it an accident, be it hospitalization, whatever it may be. But the question becomes, what's the tax treatment of that? And the chief counsel advice looked at it from the standpoint of, okay, we have this plan where we're going to pay indemnities. How do we tax that for payroll tax purposes and for income tax purposes to the employee? The bottom line in this ruling is pretty simple. If the premiums are paid pre-tax, so for instance, the employer pays the premium directly, that can be excluded from the employee's wages. Also, we could put this into a cafeteria plan where the employee designates part of their wages to go to pay for these premiums. If that happens, it's paid pre-tax, so it wasn't included on the employee's income or wasn't paid from after-tax dollars. When the payments are received, they will be considered taxable wage income to the employee. Conversely, if the employee pays for this with after-tax dollars, then if they receive a payment later, those payments will be considered to be non-taxable to the employee. This particular memorandum actually sets up a series of questions and answers that goes into and a series of examples. And in fact, it sets up 5 detailed examples that go through the various permutations of if you have a cafeteria plan, if the employer is paying for it, the employee is paying for it, all these issues. In the materials that we have on our website, remember, if you go to currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, click on the weekly updates. If you go there to this week's update here on February the 6th, the week of February the 6th, you'll find in our PDF we have available for you there, we have given you basically examples. We modified their questions and answers to put them in the form of 5 separate examples that illustrate how you apply this. So if you have a company that is providing, many people do provide this kind of supplemental benefit option to people. You know, it's probably most well-known ways you see this are, you know, if you've seen the TV commercials from Aflac, that's the type of insurance product they sell. If you're doing that sort of thing, this is where you find some interesting guidance on the tax consequences of doing that and the payroll tax consequences of doing it. So it's a very interesting chief counsel advice and one you might want to take a look at. Next up, we get into percentage of completion method of accounting in the case of Basic Engineering Inc. versus Commissioner Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-26. This came out on February the 1st. Normally, when we think of percentage of completion method of accounting, we're only thinking of construction contractors and construction contracts. But in reality, it can apply to any situation where you start work on an obligation in 1 year and finish it in another. You know, any sort of manufacturing or construction contract. Generally, manufacturing contracts are exempt unless they involve the manufacture of a unique item of a type not normally included in the taxpayer's finished good inventory or any item that requires more than 12 months to complete. In this case, we have a firm here, Basic Engineering. They ended up signing 2 different contracts to assist in constructing new refineries. One was going to be in Bulgaria, one was going to be in Pakistan. Now, in both cases, the customer said, we don't really want to build a brand new refinery from scratch. Rather, what we're going to look at doing is we want to acquire a refinery in the U.S. and then we want you to take, you know, basically disassemble the equipment from that refinery, refurbish that equipment, ship it to us, you know, overseas, because obviously it's got to get to Bulgaria. And you know what? You're not going to put this, you're not going to put refinery equipment on a plane. This is going to involve a lot of, shall we say, freight, ship freight. So it's going to be over ocean bound across the ocean. And then once you get across the ocean, you still got to get it inland. So it's going to be a mess to haul over. And then we're going to reassemble this stuff at the, you know, in the new plant location. And after that's done, we need to test this because obviously you don't really want to just kind of throw the switch without testing on a refinery. That can cause some other nasty problems. It gets, you know, petroleum is a little bit explosive. So we prefer to make sure everything's working right and then get everything certified. So all the way through that process so we can get back to starting production in our new refinery. Basic Engineering took the position initially that this was a manufacturing contract because they reported it on a completed contract type structure. That is, just like you would with any sort of standard manufacturing contract, you would not report income until you actually deliver the product. You know, many of us has probably done this. You know, if you've ever ordered a computer customized online, a lot of us do that all the time. You go to Lenovo or Apple and you say, well, I don't want an off-the-shelf one you ship tomorrow. I want you to modify this, add this RAM, put this hard drive in, do a couple of extra things. Well, you know, they obviously have to go build that machine, but they don't recognize the income from that machine until they complete the build and ship it to you. And they said, well, this is similar. Well, the tax court wasn't so sure it really wasn't a construction contract, but they said, anyway, here's the first problem. As a manufacturing contract, that doesn't automatically mean you don't have percentage of completion. And the taxpayer's own expert admitted that the work in question on this would generally take more than 12 months just to refurbish the equipment. So bottom line, the tax court said, if it's a manufacturing contract, you need to be on a percentage of completion method. Well, the taxpayers then had a secondary thing. He said, okay, then maybe it is a construction contract. Well, now construction contracts normally have to be on percentage completion method, but there is one exception that's potentially relevant here. We don't need to use percentage completion method if the taxpayer's average annual gross receipt for the 3 years before the contract is entered into do not exceed $10 million. Taxpayer qualified for that in this case. But the second issue is the taxpayer estimates at the time the contract is entered into that the contract will take less than 2 years to complete. That turned out to be a problem for the taxpayer. The tax court took a look at this situation and said, look, first thing is the taxpayer tried to just look at the time to refurbish the equipment. Tax court said, that's not right. It's got to be refurbished. Then you've got to ship it. The shipping process will take at least 6 months to get the stuff across the ocean, then overland and on site. At that point, you then have to reassemble everything, which is not going to be a quick process. And it's going to take many months to go through the testing process and get certification, all of which are part of your process. So the court found that they had not demonstrated that they reasonably expected all of that to happen in less than 2 years. So for both of those reasons, the court said whether it was a construction contract or whether it was a manufacturing contract, the taxpayer was required to use percentage of completion method, which obviously had the effect of accelerating the reporting of income. Next up, the case of Flume versus Commissioner. And this looks at our first of two reasonable cause cases today. In this case, Flume versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2017-21, that was issued on January the 31st. Now, Edward Flume was looking at penalties of $110,000 for failing to file Form 5471. 5471 generally, and that was from years 2001 through 2009. There were two companies involved by the time we're done with this that he failed to file it on, and the penalty is $10,000 per year for each time he fails to do it. Generally, if a person controls a foreign corporation, they're required to file this information return with the IRS every year. And again, failing to do so triggers a $10,000 penalty. And there's a problem there. Now, the penalty can get nastier if you fail to provide the information more than 90 days after the IRS asks for it, too, if they notice it. So he had some problems here. He's looking at $110,000 of penalties. Ultimately, the court concluded that Mr. Flume definitely did have a reporting obligation. Well, he said, well, okay, maybe that's true, but this is complicated, and I had hired a tax professional to help me with this. Well, he had hired, basically, a tax preparation firm in Mexico to prepare his tax returns. Fine. And Ms. Luna, who was a employee of the organization, prepared his returns. She had not prepared Form 5471, nor had she advised him that he needed to file that form. The court found, however, okay, the problem here is the mere fact she didn't prepare it does not mean he relied upon her. The court found a couple of problems. One key fact was he had not actually told Ms. Luna that he owned interest in these corporations until approximately sometime in 2008, toward the end of this time period. So certainly for the vast majority of years, if you never told the preparer you had an interest in foreign corporations, there was no way you could have relied on her advice that you needed to file the form. Don't tell him, can't know. But secondly, the court found he admitted that he had never really asked about Ms. Luna's qualifications. So you also have to reasonably find a professional that, you know, you don't have to actually prove that they're competent in the area, but you need to make inquiries based on your level of knowledge to take reasonable steps to find somebody that is reasonably, you can reasonably expect knows what they're doing. Had he never given Basically, he had never really asked those questions, he could not rely on them. In fact, to show reasonable cause to rely on advice, what a taxpayer needs to show is they had engaged the preparer to advise basically him or her on the matter in question, that the taxpayer made reasonable inquiries to assure themselves that the preparer had the proper expertise to give advice on the matter in question. The taxpayer provided the preparer with all information necessary to advise the situation. And finally, they actually relied on that advice that was given. In this case, he could show none of that, and therefore he was subjected to the penalties of over $100,000. Finally, we have the case of United States versus Little. This was reported in the American Federal Tax Reporter, 119 AFTR 2nd, paragraph 2017-381. It is a case from the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of California. The opinion came down on January the 23rd. This is the case of United States versus Little. Now, he was the CEO of two different companies. At some point, he discovered one of the companies had not paid its trust fund taxes. And he talked with the CFO, he talked with the board. They indicated that it was their position the company was going to pay the taxes. But nevertheless, he and the CFO agreed to go ahead and before paying the trust fund taxes, they allowed other things to be paid, such as payroll and other expenses. Now, this goes on for a while and he doesn't really check up. Later, it's discovered that a second company, which by the way had the same CFO, had also fallen behind in which he was CEO. And again, he's aware of the problem, but he again allows for the payroll taxes to be paid. Now, Mr. Little agrees that he's a responsible party, but he says, but he behaved reasonably. He said, you know, what I did was I just paid the things that were absolutely necessary to keep the company going. And because of that, I acted reasonably and I should not be liable for the trust fund penalty. Well, the district court in California pointed out one big problem with Mr. Little's defense. While some courts of appeal, some circuits allow for a reasonable cause defense, specifically they mention cases in the 2nd, 5th, and 10th circuit that allowed for reasonable cause defense. In case situations, I will point out, that weren't really quite like his. But nevertheless, they had allowed for it. The 9th circuit has continually held that there is no reasonable cause defense. In fact, that's all that matters is you allowed other people to be paid. That's good enough. Even reckless disregard of whether the tax is being paid over, as distinguished from actual knowledge, is sufficient to establish willfulness. The 9th Circuit has admitted that this seems unfair, but they took the position that the law itself requires that treatment. In this case, because he was a responsible person. He had allowed taxes to be, he had allowed expenses to be paid that were not trust fund payments at a time when trust fund taxes were still outstanding. They held he's absolutely liable. You cannot attempt to argue that you acted reasonably. That simply is not a defense in the 9th Circuit. I would point out, if you go take a look at what they cited in the case, that probably the result in this case would not have been different in the 2nd, 5th, or 10th circuit. What you have to look at, though, is the good news is if you do have a situation in those circuits, do realize there's at least a chance to argue reasonable cause. For those of us out here in the 9th circuit, I'm in Arizona, that's a 9th circuit state, we're just kind of out of luck. There is no reasonable cause for failure to pay over the trust fund taxes in the 9th Circuit Court of Appeals. So for us, we're just kind of stuck. Well, it's that time of year again. It's tax time. And hopefully you're all getting ready and I'm sure we're all gearing up to do that sort of thing. This is the time of year we all just love being around. Remember, your state society offers resources that can be very useful to you during the tax season. A number of the state societies sponsor various sorts of discussion groups, listservs, other things. They may have some live meetings to get involved in. I know that the California Society, the Tax Talk group on Yahoo Groups, which by the way is open to any CPA across the country, so useful group there. I also participate in a similar tax discussion group sponsored by my home society, which is the Arizona Society of CPAs. But a lot of other groups provide discussions. They provide resources. Check with your state society. There are lots of ways to get help during the coming tax season. If you just take a look and take a look at what your society offers, many times I think we neglect to take a look there and fail to discover very useful resources that are very helpful to us during this time of year. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for February the 6th, 2017. Be sure to check our website for updates during the week at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com, where you'll find information about developments as they occur. We also have the option there if you want to. There's a sign up for the email. So if you want to get the articles emailed to you in the morning, the day after we post them, you can also do that. They come out middle of the night, so they'll be there the next morning for you. We also, if you have any questions or comments, be sure to send those to me, edzawas@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. On the website, on the weekly updates, we do also have a PDF with the full articles that out that go behind everything I talked about today. So if you want to check those, that PDF, it's an 11-page PDF that has these articles. You can find that there. You can also follow me on Twitter. My handle there is @EdZollers. Well, have a good time. We're in February. We're coming up on the day when we actually get the brokerage statements. February 15th is approaching. So take care, enjoy your tax season, and join us back here next week for more developments in the area of federal taxes.